Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Harris v. Acadia Investments. Mr. Hershey.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. First, a brief background. My name is Lauren Hershey. I'm appearing pro se. I am an attorney. I'm licensed to practice in the state of Ohio, where I was born, on a different lake, Lake Erie. I moved to Washington, D.C. in 1976, and my very first job brought me to Chicago with the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, an independent regulatory agency, and I worked in the General Counsel's office. So I began to develop a certain, if you will, understanding of law and policy as it emanates back and forth between Washington, D.C. and the states and as administered by the federal courts. That's a brief background that you wouldn't know from any of the papers that are presented. We are the appellant here.
Now, Mr. Hershey, are you at this point representing only yourself and not Acadia?
Technically, I do not represent Acadia, but I believe to get to the issue of guarantee, you have to get to the issue of the...
No, I don't mean about discussing, but you are here representing
your own
interest and not anything.
But I believe that I have to make all the arguments that have to be applied to determine whether it was appropriate for summary judgment to be rendered by Judge Gettleman to address the questions of the contract, the underlying contract, the Illinois Credit Agreements Act, and I think all those questions have to be on the table, not simply as to the role of guarantor, but as to the contracting party, the primary obligor, Acadia Investments, Limited Liability Company, or formerly L period, C period under the Virginia Code.
Right. Well, you understand why I'm asking, because you said you're appearing pro se, and I don't know if you're a member of the bar of this court or not. But
I am not, Judge Wood. And I appreciate being able to answer that question and to clarify any of these points. I have posed a large question here, but I have a tremendous burden on appeal. Summary judgment is rendered on pleadings, admissions, affidavits, and Judge Gettleman read what he had in front of him and made a determination. There was no evidentiary proceeding below, other than the pleadings that were put forward, and that included admissions by way of stipulations under Rule 56. The moving party, the bank, bore the initial burden of demonstrating the absence of a genuine issue of material fact, but here the non-moving party bears the burden of proof on a dispositive issue. So I have to get to dispositive issues. And more than that, as I read Roger v. Yellow Freight Systems, Inc., which is your law in the Seventh Circuit, it says, in such a situation, the non-moving party may not rest on the allegations and the pleadings, but must offer specific evidence. And that's a difficulty, Your Honors, because I have to go into a lot of detail, and I'd like to do that. And where I'd like to start is with the Illinois Credit Agreements Act. Because I believe the act applies, and I believe perhaps the exception applies.
But, you know, I can't see how it can possibly apply. Let me give you an example. Suppose a person that we'll just call Jones owns a sporting goods store, and Jones operates this as a family business. You know, his wife, his kids help with the business, and he gets a loan to buy inventory for the sporting goods store. And he takes the profits from the store and buys a house with it, buys his household goods. So in that sense, his entire operation is certainly for family business. But my understanding of the Illinois statute is it would regard that loan as a business loan. It's not a family loan. And I don't see what's the difference between the money that Acadia got to run its businesses. Part of it may have been for personal use of the shareholders. Part of it may have been to enrich the company. But it strikes me as it's entirely within the Illinois statute.
Judge Wood, I think that's the way Judge Gettleman saw it.
And well,
I respect that.
And
I understand that. What I am here to argue is that the Illinois Credit Agreement Act applies, and we have to examine the contract.
Why does it apply?
Right.
I would like to start. Well, I read the definition of the credit agreement, which I accept. Obviously, it's a law in Illinois. I read, and that's in Section 160/1 definitions. Very short act. I've read it many times. I've read all of the precedents.
Why does it apply, particularly in light of paragraph 7 of the bank's statement of material facts offered in summary judgment, which you did not contest? The primary purpose of this revolving credit facility was to allow Acadia to finance contributions and capital calls into various private equity funds, hedge funds, and real estate funds that Acadia both then owned and would subsequently acquire, et cetera, et cetera. None of that is personal use.
Judge Hamilton, I agree entirely. Our first argument as appellant is to look at the restatement of the law of contracts, to look at Black defining promise and promissory estoppel. I think there are fundamental places to start. The mutuality here has not been fully examined, I believe, by Judge Gettleman.
You're not answering my question. Why doesn't the ICAA apply?
It does
particularly
apply
in light of your admission in paragraph 7 about the purpose of the loan.
That is absolutely an accurate statement rendered in the loan agreement, and I would read sections of the loan agreement to you, Judge Hamilton. I don't think I have the time to do that. But
you don't need to, though, because if it applies, as the section that Judge Hamilton just read certainly seems to indicate, then the oral representations or the emails that are not actually formal written modifications to the agreement are neither here nor there. And you were in default, or actually Acadia was in default, which thus triggered the acceleration, triggers the obligation of the guarantor, and this case is over.
Well, I believe that the acceleration has to be examined on the merits. I believe that our affirmative defenses are considerable, ought to be considered by judges reviewing the entirety of a contract. This contract probably has 40 or 50,000 words. There are definitions in here of material adverse effect, and I want to go right to that point, if I may. In the acceleration letter, which I invite you to read in its entirety, it is based on the technicalities of the situation that you judges have expressed your understanding.
It's based on the fact that the forbearance agreement had expired, and the acceleration letter comes about 3 days later, and Harris exercises its right under the agreement.
With all due respect, Judge Wood, the particulars of the record have to do with an attempt to negotiate an extension of time. I would invite you to read 3.5 of the loan agreement dated February 5th, 2008, and it defines an ability to insist on what the maturity date of this loan agreement ought to be. An acceleration is an exceptional act.
The bank had the right to do that under the forbearance agreement after it expired. You admitted you were in default. You admitted you had no defenses as part of the forbearance agreement.
Judge, with all due respect, I don't think we conceded that there were no affirmative defenses. I believe under the law of contract in Illinois, under the Illinois Credit Agreements Act, affirmative defenses can be recognized.
Mr. Hershey,
you have to look to specificity of the
defense. You keep telling us what you believe. What we have yet to hear is evidence and authority.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I believe that the authority has to be rendered by judges interpreting contract law, fundamental black letter contract law. An affirmative defense that is based on an examination of the transaction as a whole, which includes all of the mutually binding covenants in the agreement. If I do want to get to, is there
but
an interpretation of the policy
that says even though you were in default in January, even though you said that as part of the forbearance agreement, and even though by the end of the period of the forbearance agreement, August the 6th, the $3 million still had not been paid, I don't see a single clause in any agreement that's been put before us. And you should give this court some credit because we are known to prepare very well for these arguments. You're not telling me anything specific, and I gather you're not telling Judge Hamilton anything specific either.
I want to go to, you said emails are not admissible. I believe that a promise that induces.
I said it wasn't the same thing as a written change to the contract.
Well, I think there's an interpretation question here. I think that there are express covenants within the forbearance agreement and Second Amendment that contemplate what the parties will do in seeing to it that a downstroke is done pursuant to the agreement. The
that
inducement to enter
nothing
into that, I think, is a contract
principle. Mr. Hershey,
principle.
It's usually a good idea to listen to what Judge Wood has to say.
Yes, sir.
And I'm going to tell you that the email that you're relying on, which is kind of a preliminary notion, maybe if a price is accepted will help you sell something, is by no means any kind of conclusive change to either the underlying loan or the forbearance agreement.
Your Honor, I believe that the bank expressly consented to a specifically identified piece of property of Acadia that would be sold, and that the bank was the source.
And what is your evidence of that?
Well, there are actually two emails involved, and I've gone to the second email that's dated May 9th. And Judge Wood, with all due respect, yes, there was a termination date on August 6th. There was a notice of default and an interest payment on August 11th. Acadia tendered 10 different repeat payments of interest, which was rejected. Now, the loan agreement, I'm going through the sequence here, provides that the bank shall accept. It's in 3.6. I invite you to read 3.6. It's their drafted covenant within the fundamental loan agreement. They shouldn't have had the opportunity to send this back. I believe it was a predicate to try to lay the groundwork further, not only as to we didn't help you sell the 1.85 million piece of instrument that we had a market to make for you, but we also are going to reject your interest payments so that if it comes before a court, we're going to say we have three or four or five different reasons. I'll allow the bank's counsel to speak for himself.
So but I believe that is in the May 26, 2009 email quoted
I said
on
May
9th,
yes. I said May 9th. I meant May 26th. Yes. And that was during the pendency of this agreement being on the table.
But that's
and
not a...
These were extraordinary times. So economic duress is something I believe is a contract principle that a court has to look at.
It was duress on the part of the bank to assert its rights under the contract?
Was it duress on the part of the bank?
Yes.
No, I think it was a coercive act on the part of the bank. I think there were acts, arguably, of deceit. We
because
didn't sue under fraud.
Because a borrower was not making payments due. Let me ask you about a different factual issue, Mr. Hershey.
Yes, sir.
You were very critical in your brief of the bank's refusal to look in September of 2009, as they're declaring default and moving to collect, of refusing to look at Acadia's 2008 tax return that had just been provided to them. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the acceleration letter...
Because that showed, I believe you said, $56 million in assets, right?
And it's signed under penalty of perjury.
Now, did that tax return reflect the value of Acadia's assets as of December 31st, 2008?
It did.
And in those extraordinary times, what probative value, what material commercial value, would the value of assets more than 8 months earlier have had for the bank when you're already in default?
Judge Hamilton, that is exactly the question transactionally that I think the bank failed to address in its acceleration letter. Material adverse effect is a defined term. It's at page 15, Bates number 276. I invite you to look at it. Material adverse effect used in the commercial practice of banking, and the bank did not even look or present or argue or hire anybody to say that Acadia, the primary obligor, somehow, because of the circumstances of the market, had a in place a material adverse effect. It's defined. It's a conventional definition. I'd read it to you, but I don't have enough time to do that, and I would like to have some rebuttal time, if I may.
While you're doing that, I want to raise one question with you to think about, which is why we should not impose sanctions under Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 38 for a meritless appeal that looks like nothing more than a stalling mechanism without evidence or law to support it. You don't need to answer that right now, but I hope you will on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Hershey. Mr. Audley.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Excuse me. My name is David Audley, and I am the attorney representing the athlete Harris Bank. Without trying to go over every point that the panel raised with Mr. Hershey, I'd like to at least pick up on a couple of the latter points that were raised. In the forbearance agreement, as relating to Mr. Hershey's allegation or pointing to some proof, the email of May 26th, for example, the forbearance agreement covers off exactly that security that the bank was prepared to assist Mr. Hershey in regards to it, and particularly at Section 8 of the forbearance agreement said, we consent. Please go out and sell it. please go out and sell it and bring the proceeds to the bank because you've defaulted on the $3 million downstroke, which was really the basis throughout this entire relationship, which I do not believe that the appellee or the appellant contests that there was a default. I mean, we have a series of loan agreements here, written agreements, that certainly we believe the ICAA applies. It just does. It just, all of the case law that we've cited that obviously Your Honors have read, I mean, this just fits the ICAA. I believe we have an admission from the appellant that it indeed does fit. But we have the credit agreement. We have a First Amendment, working in good faith, all in writing. Then we have a default on an absolutely required $3 million downstroke as of January 31st of 2009. Doesn't happen. Then there's a negotiation period in good faith. Indeed, looking at the record which Your Honors have looked at, the forbearance agreement wasn't even executed by Mr. Hershey on behalf of himself and Acadia until June of 2009. I mean, this was not an oppressive, here's a document, you have 2 days to sign this. This was an overarching relationship looking at it, the bank just seeking to get repaid. So there was no economic duress or any pressure from a timing perspective, let alone from the substance perspective. And then even in the forbearance agreement, there's an addressing of the issues that Mr. Hershey believes emails modify. So it's even further from at least the bank's perspective that even if you give any weight to the emails whatsoever, they're trumped by the express terms of the forbearance agreement, specifically that were agreed to by Acadia and Mr. Hershey.
Mr. Olney, could I just ask you a question about how all of this relates to the bankruptcy proceeding that's going on? I assume Harris has filed claims in that?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it's not yet resolved. What's the status?
The status, Your Honor, as the Seventh Circuit has been receiving periodic status reports from
right.
the Bankruptcy Council.
Quite a few
council.
Of them, actually.
okay. Yes, Your Honor. The current status is as follows. By the end of February of this year, there hopefully will be a hearing, although it may be extended to March, that would provide for an effective date for the plan of reorganization. However, Mr. Hershey has appealed from the bankruptcy judge's approval of that plan of reorganization, so we don't know if there's going to be a stay involved there or not. So I cannot represent to you that that plan of reorganization effective date is going to happen within 30, 60, or 90 days. I presume the bankruptcy counsel will be able to update the Seventh Circuit in its next status report. But again, that goes to the point, again, respectfully, of the delay here and what's really going on. A bankruptcy judge, after a full 3 or 4 day evidentiary hearing down in Virginia, approved a bankruptcy plan agreed to between the bank and Acadia, with Mr. Hershey objecting, and Mr. Hershey saying he's going to appeal the court's confirmation, and that may or may not impact on the effective date of that plan, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Could I ask you also, Mr. Audley, to address a factual issue that at least it seems a little confusing to me? Mr. Hershey seems to be arguing that in the calculation of prejudgment interest, there was a failure to account for some several hundred thousand dollars of payments. Were those payments actually made to the bank?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Can you help clarify what it is we're talking about and direct me to some place in the record that will illuminate it?
Yes, Your Honor. As the court, as the panel is aware, Judge Gettleman, by the consent of all the parties, including predecessor counsel to Mr. Hershey, agreed to have Magistrate Judge Schenker deal with the interest issue, the prejudgment interest issue. We appear before Judge Schenker, and this is leading up to answer your question, Your Honor, on December 20th of 2010, and from there, Judge Schenker said, what are we really talking about, frankly? He said it on the record. How much money is the difference between this $5 million tranche or the $15.5 million, whether it's 6 months that the LIBOR rate should apply or 1 year? How much are we really talking about? Predecessor counsel and I said to the court, about $50,000. Judge Schenker rightfully looked at us and said, you're going to run through that with the attorney's fees. This is what I'll do, though, Judge Schenker said. I'll set January 14th of the following year for a hearing date if you really want to fight this. But why don't you two get together and see if you can reach an agreement? And indeed, that's what happened. On January 7th of the following year, we reported that we had reached an agreement. Then on January 27th, these are all in the transcripts and the supplement to the record, we reported, both sides again reported again, we had reached an agreement as to the dollar amount. However, Mr. Hershey, at least then represented by counsel, indicated that they wanted a delay in the entry of the final order to see if they could sell some more assets to see if they could make the downstroke. As part of the January 27th transcript, there's a reference at the end where there's a discussion by predecessor counsel to Judge Shankar that says, and by the way, there may be a $355,000 payment that, as part of a settlement, Acadia and Hershey would allow to go to the bank if we reach a settlement agreement, because one of the private equity funds was anticipating a distribution at or about that dollar amount.
Now, could I interrupt and ask whether the significance of that is what the final amount of money would be for which the prejudgment interest rate would apply? I mean, I assume if Harris gets a payment of $355,000, it will credit that against the liability at this point, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And we did not receive it. We had not received any of $355,000 by February 4th when the judge approved the form, agreed order, or on February 8th when it was stipulated and entered. As a matter of fact, the bank didn't receive any funds until it then issued citations to Discover assets pursuant to the federal court's adoption of the Illinois state court procedures in that regard, and then had to send out citations to the various funds. And then in responding to those funds, on a non-consensual basis, payments have been received by the bank, all of which is being credited, both will be credited to Mr. Hershey as the guarantor and is being credited in the bankruptcy as part of the proof of claim filed by the bank in that proceeding. So, Your Honor, I hope that answers the question. It was at the end of a transcript comment that if we reached an agreement, which never was reached, then Acadia and Hershey would be willing to allow consensually that money to come to the bank, and it never did.
So it certainly had not come to the bank as of the January 27 status hearing or as of the date the judgment is entered?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Nothing in that regard. And I know there was a bit of confusion there. And the other part, again, of the appeal here is that Mr. Hershey then, after parting ways with predecessor counsel, both made an oral motion and then a subsequent written motion that suggested that predecessor counsel didn't have the authority to stipulate to that prejudgment interest amount. But Judge Shankar heard out Mr. Hershey, who appeared pro se at that point, and simply believed this was a stipulation, this was entered, you haven't showed any gross injustice that would envelop because I need to somehow undo that dollar amount that has been agreed to. And again, the dollar amount came to, frankly, King Solomon in that approach between the two lawyers. I'm prepared to go into some further detail if the panel wishes to hear anything or has any further questions, but otherwise we would stand on the briefs.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hershey.
Briefly in rebuttal and to respond to some of the questions that were posed, and if I may, I did want to invite the Court's attention to very specific provisions in the definition section of the loan agreement of February 5, 2008. It's an unusual document. The bank, and I make this argument in the pleadings, was operating through maybe an affiliate, maybe a wholly owned subsidiary, maybe just a parallel functioning entity. That entity is known as Harris My CFO, Inc. It is a federally registered investment advisor. It has a different set of duties. There's a subjectivity consideration. The contracts are objective, but the perspectives of the party are going to be determined by what is happening within the contract and the contractual arrangements. Our perception was that this Harris My CFO, Inc. separate entity had some kind of a delegation of authority to negotiate on behalf of the bank. But it was owing at that time, and I call it dual-handed, duties to its customer, the Hershey family. So you actually have a parallel. Now, I don't think we're going to administer the Investment Advisors Act of 1940 here. I argue that as a consideration of reasonableness in the conduct of business, with the evolving economy, evolving financial institutions, and this specific loan arrangement, this Court should be looking at how a family is going to look at a loan arrangement in the doing of what is to be not just a three-year, could be a five-year. I've invited you to look at 3.5 that deals with extension requests that were permitted, or what was being negotiated with my CFO was an more or less in perpetuity arrangement. Now, you don't see that. Judge Gettleman didn't get to see that because I didn't get, or former counsel Bill Barrett, the opportunity to present to Judge Gettleman, but I have to present it to this panel. It is present.
Were you unable to present it to Judge Gettleman, that argument?
Well, we weren't given the opportunity to argue the summary judgment motion.
Well, but why wasn't it part of a pleading?
I believe there's, as counsel for the bank has said, there was a certain amount of confusion. I see I have a red light here.
Yes, but I think you have to answer an inquiry made by Judge Hamilton as to the sanctions issue.
Judge Hamilton, I would ask permission to address that in writing, if I may. I believe that there were merits in the position of the Hershey family, of Lauren Hershey as guarantor of Acadia, in being able to argue that it entered into an agreement in good faith and expected the other side to act in good faith. I believe that the acceleration agreement has never been fully examined with specificity, with specific facts, to determine whether or not it was fairly rendered.
You may have 10 days to file such a response to the inquiry put by the court on sanctions.
Yeah, I will read the record and I will respond.
February 25th.
I will respond, Judge Hamilton.
Thanks to counsel, and the case is taken under advisement.